Maine's June primary is drawing near, and today we bring you another in our series of Your Vote 2018 interviews with the candidates vying for their party's nominations in the race for governor and 2nd District congressional seat. If you miss either of our candidate interviews in this hour, you can hear all 14 conversations at mainepublic.org/yourvote. You can also learn more about each of the candidates and see their positions broken down on an easy-to-use issues grid near the top of our Your Vote 2018 page. Today we'll hear from Democrat Lucas St. Clair and Republican Garrett Mason. St. Clair is executive director of Elliottsville Plantation, Inc., a land conservation organization. He also serves on the board of the Quimby Family Foundation, formed by his mother, Roxanne Quimby, in 2004. The Quimby family donated more than 87,000 acres of Maine wilderness that became the Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument in 2016, an effort St. Clair spearheaded. St. Clair graduated from Gould Academy. He spoke with Maine Public's Mal Leary.
Lucas, there are three Democrats seeking the nomination in the 2nd Congressional District. What specific proposal or proposals sets you apart from the others?
I think the most specific is the support that I have for ranked choice voting and the fact that I signed on to the lawsuit for the implementation of ranked choice voting this primary election. None of the other candidates signed on to that lawsuit. But I felt like it was incredibly important to make sure that the will of the Maine people are represented in at the election.
The polls are continuing to show that jobs is the biggest concern for voters in the 2nd District, as well as the whole state, of course. What could you do, what would you do as a member of Congress to help grow Maine's economy?
I think there's a real importance in investment in infrastructure. I think without high-speed internet in most places in Maine, we have the slowest internet speeds in the country. We need to make sure that we invest in that infrastructure, our roads, our bridges, to make sure that they are smooth and strong. And I think an investment in rail would also be really important to make sure that we are able to move goods and have a system of public transportation that could quickly and efficiently move people around the state.
What could you do, though, in Congress to make that happen?
I think the work specifically in Congress would be sitting on the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee and making sure that we are looking for funding to be invested and when transportation bills come through that we're advocating to spend money on broadband and we're advocating to spend money on rail specifically.
What do you see as the most pressing issue that's before the country, and what would you do to address it?
Healthcare, without a doubt. The most pressing issue around the country and around the state of Maine is the cost of healthcare and the volatility of the healthcare market. It's hard for providers. It's hard for rural hospitals. It's hard for the elderly population in Maine. We need to make sure that people have access to affordable healthcare when they are sick and need to see their doctor. They don't put it off because they don't think they can afford it. It's absolutely crucial.
But how do you address it? I mean, you've outlined the problem. How do you address it?
I think an expansion of Medicare, put together a universal healthcare system. And my feeling, the best way to do that is expanding Medicare so everyone is eligible. And it's a system that we all pay into. We make investments in and we should be able to have a return on that investment for the long term.
So how would that work?
Well, it would be continued the way it's happening now, where employees and employers pay a percentage of their salary and a percentage of earnings into the Medicare pot. And that money, I think that rate could go up slightly. And over time, a pool would be created that would pay for people's health care when they needed it. And there are some tweaks that we would have to make to the Medicare system, being able to negotiate pharmaceutical prices, for example, can't be done right now. I think that needs to be changed. But if we have a bigger system with more people in it, more constituents in it, and younger people in it, it creates a more balanced system.
Now, you mentioned this earlier in ranked choice voting. Voters participating in the June primary will be using ranked choice voting for the first time. Assuming you plan to vote for yourself as the top choice, who would be your second and third choice?
It's not clear to me who would be my second and third choice at this point. I think that this is really about beating Bruce Poliquin in November, and I think I'm the best person to do that. And so I'm really staying focused on the November election and making sure the best way to beat Bruce Poliquin.
So even though you strongly endorse ranked choice voting, you haven't decided yet yourself how to rank.
Right.
Maine is a graying state, and the 2nd District, as you're probably aware, is graying even faster than the rest of the state. Do you support any specific changes to Medicare or Social Security?
First and foremost, I don't think that they should be tampered with, and I don't think any of the funding that's directed and the investment the American people have made in Social Security and Medicare should be taken away. But a specific proposal that would change Medicare would be the prescription drug negotiation for cost. I think that would be a specific change that I would implement and advocate for in the Medicare system to make sure that people get affordable drug prices. But we need to make sure that this system is whole and that the investments that individuals have made into the system over the course of their working careers are returned to them.
And what about Social Security? Because there's been a lot of agitation that there shouldn't be this arbitrary cutoff as to how much you tax.
Yeah, I agree. I think there should be an expansion of, I think it's $126,000 a year. I think that people earning more than that should pay more than that. And I don't think there should be that arbitrary cutoff. It's a system that works very well. And if we are really truly going to think about people retiring as their golden years, it's not being felt that way right now. And so I think we need to make sure that people have a retirement that they can live on.
President Trump's imposed tariffs on steel and aluminum, and some Maine companies are already being hurt by that. Do you support these tariffs, and why or why not?
I don't support them because I think that we rely on imported steel and aluminum. I mean, if my grandfather worked for Bethlehem Steel his entire career, but Bethlehem Steel is no longer operating. And if we were making a lot of steel and aluminum in this country right now and being able to provide for ourselves, it would be different. But we're not. And we're part of a global community, and we need to have good faith in our relationships with other countries and make sure that we are providing raw materials in an affordable way so we can make the things that we make here. It's affecting Bath Iron Works directly here in Maine. So I think we need to be very clear that we're not trying to create trade wars and that we are a partner in this global trade community.
Name one issue on which you see yourself voting against the wishes of your party leadership and why.
I think the one issue that I see is surveillance and some of the rules that the party has, or some of the issues that the party has voted on, the Democratic Party has voted on around surveillance, make me a little cautious and I'm not completely supportive of.
How so?
Well, I think, you know, Americans have the right to to not be monitored over, you know, and to unnecessary wiretaps and things along those lines. I think we have a right to our privacy, and so that's one issue that I think comes up to me.
So you think the balance has gone too far, because it's obviously the Pfizer law is there to try to go after terrorists,
right?
And there needs to be a warrant in order to do a wiretap. You're saying it's going too far?
Yeah, I think it has gone too far.
Do you intend to hold what I would call the traditional town hall style meetings to hear from your constituents? And if so, what restrictions would you put on those who are attending those meetings?
I would absolutely do those town halls, and I've been doing them in this election cycle, and I've been opening up our Bangor office on a biweekly basis to make sure that people can come in and talk to us about what's on most important for them and how opportunities and challenges are emerging in their communities and what are their needs and what a congressman can do for them. I think it's the most important thing that we can do as a representative of 600,000 people in this country is making sure that we're hearing from them directly. You know, we have to create order during these town hall meetings. And so I think it's important to be able to have as many voices heard as possible. And I think having a moderator that is able to call on people from the audience or written questions and things like that. But over the course of the last 5 years, when I was working on Katahdin Woods and Waters, we had many, many town hall meetings. And we really focused on making sure that everyone had a voice and we were able to hear both from opponents and from supporters, but do it in a civil, orderly way where people aren't insulting each other. And, you know, it's okay to have emotion and have that emotion expressed, but we have to do it in a civil way.
Recreational use of marijuana is now legal in Maine, as you know. Would you support Congress legalizing recreational use nationally?
I would.
Why or why not?
I would. And I think the decriminalization of marijuana, it can be very helpful for people with certain medical issues. And I think it can be treated the way alcohol is treated. We need to make sure that people are using it in a safe way and the general public is being safe. But I absolutely support it.
Do you see any problems with law enforcement as a result of this? Because what they're saying is if you legalize marijuana, it's a gateway drug to other more serious drugs.
I don't see evidence of it being a gateway drug. I see more evidence of people using it to relieve pain and stress and to help people get off of more damaging drugs.
Congress is considering a number of gun violence-related measures. Where do you stand on each of the following proposals and why? Raising the age to purchase a rifle to 21.
I support that.
And why?
I think it's a good thing as you get older, you get more mature and you can make better decisions. I think that raising the age is important and allows people's brains to develop and make better decisions.
What about the argument that if you can vote at 21, you can serve in the military at 18? I mean, why can't you buy a gun at 18? You've heard that, I'm sure.
Yeah. So if you serve in the military, you're trained to use it. And I'm not saying that if you're under 21, you shouldn't be able to use a gun. I was using a gun when I was 8 years old, when I was hunting with my father and my grandfather. But I went and took a hunter's safety course and I passed a test. And then I was with adult supervision.
What about the proposal that would ban the sales of semi-automatic weapons?
So I don't support that. I'm a duck hunter and I have a semi-automatic shotgun. So banning all semi-automatic weapons is not something I support.
What about the sale of large ammunition magazines? That's another proposal that's pending currently before Congress.
Yeah, high-capacity magazines is a different story. And that's something I do support. I think when I'm duck hunting, again, with my semi-automatic shotgun, I am only allowed to have 3 shells in the gun at any time. That's the law for hunting and hunting deer. Is you can have 5 bullets in your rifle at any time. So we're already living with these limitations when it comes to hunting. I'm perfectly happy with that. And if you need more, you know, I don't think there's a reason to have more shells or more bullets in your gun.
President Trump continues to insist on spending billions of dollars to build a border wall with Mexico. There are other pressing infrastructure needs such as roads and bridges, high-speed internet access. Please rank in order of the importance you would place on these three, that is, internet access, the border wall, or roads.
I think internet access is the most important thing, and a high-speed internet access, and then roads and bridges, and then a wall.
Do you see that as a policy that the Democrats will be pushing in Congress?
I hope so. I know that there's been resistance to the urge to build a wall. Certainly, that's something that Democrats are not going to want to fund. I think the issues and the needs in rural Maine and rural America are different than in urban areas. So I'm not sure if Democrats in urban centers are going to be wanting to advocate for a high-speed internet because they probably have it in their communities. But as a representative of a rural place that has slow internet speed, that is something that I'm going to advocate for and push for at every opportunity, regardless of party.
Would you support legislation that would fire Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller?
I would not. No, Robert Mueller needs to continue to be able to do his job without interference.
And the flip question there, of course, is would you support legislation that would prevent his firing?
I would.
And why?
Because same reason. You know, I think he needs to be able to do his job and be able to do it efficiently. I mean, the sooner that this investigation is over, the sooner we can get back to paying attention to the real issues. And unfortunately, this has been a massive distraction for making sure that we have investment in infrastructure and making sure that we've come up with a more equitable method of providing health care for people. And so let's get this done and so we can start focusing on the real issues that are facing people in Maine's 2nd District.
We know now from reports from several congressional committees that Russia has been trying to influence our elections. What should Congress do in response to those Russian attempts?
I think sanctions are a good thing. I think that we also need to make sure that we have an election system that can be that is free from being tampered. Paper ballots seem really important now. I love the idea of mail-in ballots in Washington and Oregon. They've gone only to mail-in ballots, and it's created a lot more engagement in the political process. I think that we need to adapt strategies for social media so they're subject to federal election rules, and you can't just put anything there, anything up there that can be shared by millions of people. We saw that playing a pretty significant role in this last election.
So more disclosure, for example, Facebook ads. Sometimes there's no disclosure there who that ad is paid for, whereas television ads, there is a disclosure of some group paying for them.
Exactly.
The drug crisis continues to claim at least a person a day in Maine. What specific policies would you advocate for in Congress to address that crisis?
Well, I think we need to fund the treatment of addiction in three ways, through prevention, and we need to put limitations on the pharmaceutical companies that are making opioids and providing them to physicians and to healthcare centers, and treating pain as a fifth vital sign. Since 1994, we've been doing that in this country, and that has caused physicians to have to treat pain in a different way. And the rise of the opioid addiction has come out of that. So prevention is a really big thing, and we could change the way physicians and healthcare providers treat pain. We need to find and fund systems for treatment. So when people show up with addiction, that it doesn't have a stigma attached to it, and treat it more like we treat diabetes, and make sure that people have health care that works with them to recover and get the treatment that they need. I think that's access to overdose prevention medicine. I think Narcan and things like that are very, very important. And then lastly, recovery, and understanding that recovery is a circuitous path and that it's not a linear path. And we would need to work with law enforcement so we're not just taking people that are suffering from addiction and putting them in jail. That is not helping them on a path to recovery. And so working with law enforcement, implementing things like drug court and making sure people get the mental health treatment that they need throughout the process of moving them toward recovery.
What about the law enforcement part? Because I've always heard from these various study groups that it's a three-legged stool, as they say. You've talked about two of them. What about the third one?
Well, law enforcement is really, I think, hamstrung at this point because of the fact that heroin and various other types of opioids are illegal so they're required to arrest people. But when the prison system is not a place for recovery, and I think focusing on rather than focusing on arresting people that are using opioids, using heroin, using fentanyl, is finding a treatment center and making sure that rather than going to prison, that they're getting the treatment that they need to stop the cycle of addiction. And that's a lot of training. That's a lot of work with law enforcement. But I've talked to a lot of people in law enforcement, and I've talked to a lot of people in the prison system that saying that the system that we have right now is not working, and we need to be able to incentivize and fund other things. And if we just say, hey, heroin's illegal, and when you're using heroin and you get caught, you're going to jail. There needs to be a more dynamic system in place to help people.
Unless the Democrats have strong majorities, you know, really large majorities in both the House and Senate, you're going to have to reach across the aisle to ensure that any of the initiatives you want to see pass. How will you do that?
There, I think, are a few things that would be important. I feel very strongly that all members of Congress need to focus more on helping the American people and understanding that we are sent to Washington not to put partisan hides on the wall, but to serve the people that voted to send us to Washington to make their lives better. And I think for the most part, there's about 80% of issues out there that we all can agree on. We want our children to succeed. We want clean air to breathe. We want clean water to drink. We want to make sure that we have an equitable system where people work hard and they make an honest living. You know, let's focus on those things and not get mired down in the 20% of the things that we don't agree on. I mean, we can spend a lot of time debating gun safety, and in certain places in the country, it's really important to have that debate. But it's not that argument is not providing health care benefits to people living on a fixed income in rural Maine. And I think that it's going to be really important to start talking about the issues that are going to make people's lives better on a day-to-day basis.
But how do you reach across the aisle and talk to Republicans who may have very different ideas about how to deal, for example, with the health care crisis?
I think it's communication. It's sitting down and talking to people. And without trust and without building relationships, we don't get to take steps forward together. And you know, I learned this firsthand in the Katahdin region working on the National Monument. I worked with a lot of Republicans and a lot of independents and a lot of Democrats and a lot of people that didn't care for politics at all. And it was about building trust with one another and knowing that I have the best interest of everyone in mind, and I want to be convinced of things. I'm willing to change my mind. I'm willing to compromise. And that all comes from trust and building relationships. So if we're spending our time in Washington taking votes for 3 days and fundraising for all the other time and then head back to our districts, we're not going to know the people that we're serving with. And you know, there's 435 members of Congress. That's not too many people to get to know. And I think we need to spend more time trying to build relationships with people that we serve with.
As you know, the Trump administration wants to open up coastal areas for exploratory drilling for oil, natural gas. What about right here on the East Coast? Should we allow exploratory drilling?
I don't think we should. I mean, we've got a great opportunity in front of us right now to start producing more energy from renewable resources. We can make energy from the wind, from sun, and from the tides, and we're doing all of those things in Maine right now. I think we should continue to invest in those renewables as opposed to start searching for more of a resource that eventually is just going to run out. And we know that by burning oil and gas, we're releasing more CO2 into the atmosphere and causing a destabilization of our climate. And so why continue to do that when we already have the technology to change things? And we can do it right here in Maine.
And what role should Congress have in that? Are we talking tax credits?
No, I think more about, you know, if we're subsidizing the oil and gas industry, why not subsidize the solar and wind and tidal generation energy? And I know there's some already there, but we need to find ways to incentivize the use of renewables as opposed to incentivizing the use of oil and gas.
Easy question for you. Do you support protecting the federal status of Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument?
I do, yeah. And when the time is right, would hope that we could pass legislation that would turn it into a national park just in the very same fashion that Acadia National Park became Acadia National Park.
And how do you do that? Because as you well know, you went down and testified. There's a lot of folks in Congress right now that don't like the process by which the monument was created in the first place.
Yeah, so the Antiquities Act is the process that was used, but it was used because Congress couldn't pass legislation, and that was our first effort. And the biggest obstacle to passing legislation was Congressman Poliquin. So when we win this election and he's no longer an obstacle, I think we'll be able to move things forward in a more efficient way. And the Congress wants legislation to be passed. If they are so opposed to the use of the Antiquities Act, well, then let's not use that. Let's pass bills on regular order and create a new national park as one of those bills.
Lucas St. Clair, one of three Democrats vying for a chance to challenge incumbent Republican Bruce Poliquin in Maine's 2nd Congressional District this fall. Up next, Garrett Mason was first elected to the Maine Senate in 2010. He's currently serving his fourth term and is now the Senate Majority Leader. Mason has worked for the Portland Sea Dogs, the city's AA baseball team, and for the Lewiston Maniacs hockey team as a business administrator. He's currently a realtor with Keller Williams Realty in Portland. Mason holds a bachelor's from Pensacola Christian College and did graduate work at Southern New Hampshire University and the Art Institute of Pittsburgh. As he told Maine Public Steve Missler, he's been a constant steady hand in the legislature.
I think that's what makes me different than the other people that you see on the Republican ticket. You need somebody who has been through the mill. And I think sometimes people are looking for some big, flashy, new idea. But really what I think voters are looking for is ideas that work. And the ones that we've championed over the past 8 years have. Lower taxes have led to more people having money in their pocket. Better education in our schools, making sure that every dollar that is spent is thoughtfully spent. Those are ideas that work, and I think that you need a strong and steady leader that can do that.
What is the biggest challenge facing Maine in your view, and what would you do as governor to either remedy that or at least respond to it?
I think it's workforce development. Mm-hmm. I think that we have a problem on our hands, a chicken and the egg problem, really, of workforce and jobs. But I think what we can focus on to fix it is making sure that the product that we're turning out of our public schools is ready for workforce. The liberal arts education has to meet up with a CTE education, and they need to be combined in the right way. And then going forward, we have to have a Department of Labor that works with the Department of Education and continuing education throughout somebody's life. So I think that's a big piece of how we fix the workforce problem.
This next question is a little bit related to what you just talked about, but it's inevitably linked to the economy, which polls consistently show that's the thing that concerns voters the most. Mm. What would you do as governor to help grow the economy?
Republicans believe in baking another pie. They don't believe in splitting up this pie into smaller pieces. We are in an incredible position to grow Maine into the future. We've really set a stage where people have more money in their pocket. The state is getting more revenue. We've seen surplus after surplus. And now we have to attract those high-level jobs into our state that people are looking for. Maine has great opportunities as it is right now, but we need a governor who sees the world as it is, not as it used to be. And I'm that I would be that governor. Go out into the world, find the jobs that need to be in Maine, and make it happen.
As you know, Maine voters will be using ranked choice voting in the primary election. Now, I'm going to assume that you're going to rank yourself as the top candidate.
That's a safe assumption.
How are you going to rank the others?
Honestly, I had this conversation with my fiance the other day when ranked choice voting started to really become a reality after the court decision. And it's an interesting position to be in where you have the other candidates that you're fighting against on stage, you have to make a decision on where you're going to rank them or if you do at all. So honestly, I'm still thinking about it.
So nationally, Maine ranks relatively low in its rate of gun violence, but nearly half of domestic violence homicide in the state involve guns. Should Maine's gun laws be changed or other laws be changed that relate to guns? And if so, how?
I don't feel that guns are the issue. I feel that people are. And recognizing problems before they happen is very important. But, I remember a bill that we worked on a few years ago in part of the governor's domestic violence initiative. And, we always talk about the perpetrator having the gun. But what about the victim? Making sure that the victim has expedited access to a gun if they feel that they're in real danger. We made some changes to make that happen. You go back in time a couple of hundred years, the guns were the great equalizer. Mm-hmm. It made it made people safer. Mm-hmm. It made people who were victims of things no longer victims anymore. And we've seen that progress through time. I think that I would not support any further restrictions on gun access. Because I think that when you have an equal opportunity to access those things, that's better. The only thing that gun laws are, gun restrictions are hurting is the law abider. They're not hurting the criminal. The criminal's going to do what they're going to do. Mm-hmm. So I say give the law abider an equal chance.
Does that? I'm assuming this is there's a red flag bill in mm-hmm. the legislature which would ostensibly remove guns out of the hands of people who have been considered dangerous. I think you're opposed to that.
I am. Yeah, and I am opposed because you start to run afoul of federal HIPAA laws. When you go into a psychiatrist and you expose all of your inner demons and the things that you've struggled with in life, and a therapist diagnoses you as clinically depressed, should we be banning people because they're clinically depressed? Well, other mental disorders include things like anorexia and bulimia. Are we going to ban people from having a gun because they have a mental disorder circled around food? I don't think that's a good idea. Mm-hmm. So now we have to go into the DSM-3, which is how therapists, determine what a mental disorder is and what kind it is and how advanced it is. And we have to decide which one of those we deem dangerous. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that you shouldn't have some sort of way to flag it, but I don't think a blanket, you have a mental disability or a mental disorder of some kind is the right and proper way to do it, because I think it could be abused.
Right now, Maine is currently enjoying a really low unemployment rate, but it ranks 44th nationally in median household income. How would you help Maine workers earn more money?
Yeah, I mean, we have an interesting new problem on our hands. It's almost at a point of overemployment. Right now, as we talk, it's 2.7%. That's incredible, and that's, I think, due to the very hard work of Governor LePage and Republicans in the legislature who have championed pro-economic growth policies in the legislature that have become law. But I think, as I was talking about before, we have an incredible opportunity to grow our state. Mm-hmm. Maine is geographically positioned really unlike anybody in the world. We are a day and a half closer to Europe than New York or Boston by boat. We have the largest deep water seaport in America, in Eastport. We have one of the second largest. I don't know if it's second. It might be a little bit different on the list. But Machias is another port that is incredible. With new waterways opening in the North Atlantic, it's quicker to get to Maine than any other place in the United States other than Alaska. We have transportation advantages that no other state has. Iceland has realized that. That opens up some serious global business. There's this thing that's been going on in America where we just shuffle jobs from state to state. It happened with Kestrel in Brunswick. They went to Wisconsin. And it's happened with all kinds of other places, other employers as well. That doesn't help our country. That doesn't help our country. What does help our country is to go get people in other countries to come here, mm-hmm. come to Maine, come to America, and grow your business here. And that's the kind of thinking that we need going forward. Not just run around the United States and steal jobs. Go out, compete against the world, because Maine can. We have a brand that's recognized the world over, and the next governor has to know that.
Maine is one of the more expensive states in the country for electricity customers. Mm-hmm. That means residential and manufacturing-based customers. It's the lowest in New England, but that may not be much solace to the people who have to pay the rates here. As governor, how would you try to lower power costs?
There's one question that my administration will ask when it comes to energy, and that's how much does it cost? A few years ago, all anybody was talking about in this building was natural gas and how to get more natural gas into Maine and make sure that everybody's connected to natural gas. Well, who's talking about that now? Not very many people. We're talking about oil. It's okay. It's easier to put oil in your house. We have houses that are built around that. And we're back to that again. But I think we need to be able to be nimble in our energy strategy. You know, back in 1996, during Angus King's days in the Blaine House, it was all about expedited wind, signing long-term contracts to pay for 20 years on an energy that was not yet ready for prime time. So my administration will focus on how much it costs, being nimble to be able to take advantage of what the cheapest cost is at the time. I think one of the things we can plan long range for that is remove the 100 megawatt cap on hydropower. Unless the earth stops spinning and the moon falls out of the sky and we don't have tides anymore, rivers will still run. Mm-hmm. And that's clean, renewable power that you can use in the long term. There's a report out there right now that was done a couple of years ago, and there's 53 megawatts of electricity from Maine's rivers that could be harvested. And that is a lot of energy that is cheap and renewable and provides small business opportunity mm-hmm. for people who owns those water rights. So that's how I would focus on it.
A lot has been made over the years about attracting businesses to the state. And some believe that tax incentives are one way to do that. Do you like the current suite of programs that we have? Should we add to it? Should we subtract? Should there be more oversight of them?
There is some value in TIFs and programs that give businesses a leg up. Maine is full of small business. I mean, it's the backbone of our economy. And a lot of those programs are geared towards that small, you know, 5 to 10 employee business that is looking to maybe make the next step. You know, my dad and I, we have had an excavation company since I was, you know, 12 years old. And even today, I hop on a bulldozer if my dad needs it. You know, there's programs out there. We haven't taken any advantage of any of them, but there's programs out there that would help small businesses like that grow, prosper, and lead. But, you know, we were just talking a minute ago about bigger businesses and those salaries that, you know, give people the next step into, you know, maybe the middle class or the upper middle class. And that takes strategic planning. And, you know, shame on us for not having a plan for what's next. I think that when it comes to jobs, we can have some immediate success mm-hmm. with some of the programs you just talked about. But if we start thinking logically and clearly and looking around the world to what the trends are.
Let's transition a little bit to Maine's welfare system, which has been a focus of the current administration for the last 7.5 years. How do you feel about it at this moment? Do you feel like the programs that we offer are generous? Are they helping people out of poverty?
So when I first got elected in 2010, I remember, you know, working in Lewiston at the Colisée with the Lewiston Maniacs. People don't realize this, but lower Lisbon Street into what we call the Tree Streets is one of the poorest square miles in the United States. People would think the Bronx or maybe somewhere outside of San Antonio, but it's actually right here in Maine where the poorest square mile in the United States is. You would hear regularly about welfare fraud in the grocery line at Shaw's. You don't hear those things as much anymore. Mm-hmm. We have fixed some of the fraud, waste, and abuse that has been rampant throughout the Department of Health and Human Services, and I'm really proud of that. But as we have seen recently, when those policies are implemented by people who might not understand what being a conservative means, they can be done and implemented without a whole lot of care involved. Mm-hmm. We have a safety net over at the Department of Health and Human Services. That is, for some people, it's the last lifeline, literal lifeline. And I look at the case of these two kids that died. If our safety net can't handle two kids, we have a serious problem. You know, I'm disappointed at some of the things that have happened over there. I think that when you interject compassionate conservatism, you not only give people a hand up, but you also giving them hope for the future, not just for the immediate. And that's how my administration would look at DHHS, mm-hmm. is make sure that we are taking care of the most vulnerable. I look at something like the child abuse tip line. Should be a top priority of the Department of Health and Human Services, and we find out that 12,000 calls went unanswered. Well, if we need more people on that line, come see me.
Voters overwhelmingly approved expanding Medicaid at the polls last year. Now, I know that you are not supportive of the referendum that passed. Right. I think that's a fair assessment. As governor, would you, if you had the votes in the legislature, would you try to repeal that?
My views on Medicaid expansion are very well established over the years. I believe it is fundamentally wrong to do what we are doing with Medicaid. I believe that it is socialism, mm-hmm. and I do not believe in socialism. I believe in free markets and free people. We see right now, and these are federal government reports from both the Obama administration and the Trump administration, that say that Medicaid and Medicare, both programs, are in trouble. They're in trouble. And I don't understand why people think it's a good idea to expand on top of them. If you watch the Democrat debate on Channel 13, and this is just their words, they're not mine, they are advocating for single-payer socialized medicine. I have a fundamental disagreement with that approach. I don't begrudge them for their views, but I passionately disagree with them. We don't need to go very far to see what the results of socialized medicine are. I do not see it as a panacea. I think that it is one of the biggest mistakes that we have made and has resulted in billions of dollars in debt to our state, not to mention what it's doing to the federal government.
And specifically, one of the things that advocates for Medicaid expansion talk about a lot is how it could help the opioid epidemic that we're facing right now, because it would provide some people, a lot of people, with access to treatment and addiction services.
One of the mistakes I think we are making in the opiate crisis debate is that we forget that not all treatment actually costs money. I was just down, I was in Machias a couple of weeks ago, and I went to a faith-based program there called Arise. The governor actually gave some money to it a few years ago out of his discretionary fund, and that program is free. It has a 65% success rate, which is unheard of in opiate treatment. And it is of no cost to the people that go there, no cost to the state. It is a ministry of a church in Machias. As governor, one of my goals will be to open an office of faith-based initiatives, because that is where the opiate crisis can further be advanced. These programs work, and I'm for anything that works. That's what I'm for. And it doesn't always have to appear as a dollar amount on, you know, a Medicaid or a Medicare spreadsheet. Sometimes it's free.
Does the state pay its fair share of local education costs in your mind?
Under the law, yes. Under the law, we did meet that threshold in the last biennial budget. We far surpassed our 55%. I believe we're around 58% now that is being funded. And every school department, that changes, because every school department decides how much they pay their teachers. I use this example a lot, and it's no knock on Cape Elizabeth, but a lot of teachers that come from Lisbon High School, start their career there, end up in Cape Elizabeth. And there's one reason, because they pay more. Mm-hmm. I don't begrudge that. And they want to make that investment in their community, and that's great. But your zip code should not determine the level of teacher that you get. I think that the governor's proposals in the past to take over a statewide teacher's contract does a couple of things. Number one, it guarantees good teachers in good communities all across the state, not just a few. It also increases the state share of how much we would pay. I think estimates were over 60% of the total cost of education would be paid if we took on a statewide teacher's contract and did the formula differently on how much each school got. I think that's something that we could really move on.
You've been a big critic of Maine's referendum process of late. Mm-hmm. What do you think Maine should do to reform and overhaul the process?
I believe that the citizens' initiative process is the biggest threat to our state, and it is not, maybe in the words of some of my Republican friends, it's not increased regulation, it's not increased taxes, maybe to my Democrat friends, it's not, you know, reduction in social services or anything like that. It is the citizens' initiative process. Mm-hmm. I have watched this for years. We'll take ranked choice voting for an example, I've been dealing with this issue for 6 years, and I've been screaming from the rooftops that it is unconstitutional and we are going to have major problems if we implement it. And lo and behold, here we go. Mm-hmm. We're going to have major problems. This will be in court, and we look like a post-Soviet Ukraine trying to do an election for the first time. Mm-hmm. It's shameful, and that's because of the folks from the Committee of Ranked Choice Voting lying to Maine people with glossy, you know, ads in the mail and TV ads. I think that we can reform the system, but it's going to take courage from the left to stand up and say, you're right, this is being corrupted, and we need to preserve this process. I think we can make sure that both districts of the state are represented in getting signatures. Unfortunately, that failed in the House a couple of weeks ago. I think that we can give the governor veto power, just like he does have over any other bill, you know, over a citizens' referendum after it's passed. It's just not fair to say that this is the unbreakable will of the people in one simple yes or no question. There's a lot of details that need to be discussed, and I don't believe that you can garner the will of the people out of a simple question that's not always simple.
It seems these days that there's a working theory that the country is so polarized that it's best for elected officials such as yourself or anybody, once they're elected, to base govern, to keep their supporters very happy and loyal rather than agree to compromise or build coalitions that could alienate the people who put them in office, right, or help get them there. Do you believe that's true? Is that actually happening? And if you do, what can be done about it?
I don't know that anybody governs from that perspective. I think sometimes the process itself, I mean, you're elected by the people in your district or your state to govern from a set of principles that you've outlined in a campaign. It's a product of the world that we live in. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, it really goes back to the time-honored principle of just, you can't dehumanize the person that you're sitting across from. They're a person with a family and a story and a reason why they have the set of principles that they have. I mean, I'm just as conservative as anybody else, but I think you'll find that most anybody in the legislature, when they need to talk to somebody in the Senate, they know my door's open.
Yeah. So candidates for governor, I haven't heard much about this campaign cycle, but in the past, they've often talked about transparency in government. And I guess, how important is that to you?
I think that there is obviously a need for the citizenry and the press to have access to the records of the government. I don't think that that's I think that everybody agrees with that. I hope I'm not speaking a little too hasty on it, but I hope that people would agree with that. But I know that it also has been completely abused, you know, and it's not necessarily by the press. I think that maybe there should be some parameters and some discernment on how to turn over records and what records are available. I don't disagree that people should have access to their government and those records should be available for public scrutiny.
This is a little bit of a, I guess, a governing philosophy question, but you know, obviously governors can sign bills into law, but what else can it do? What else can a governor do to sort of improve the lives of Mainers?
I think that that is one of the most important things to understand as somebody who is going to be the next governor or wants to be the next governor, is understanding what the governor actually does. All the time on Democrats, Republicans, Independents, I hear these claims made of, you know, I'm going to make sure that we fix the citizens' initiative process. I'm going to make sure we do this. No, you're not. None of you are, including myself, because that's not what the governor does. The governor runs the bureaucracy. The governor is the final check on the legislature and what they're passing. Mm-hmm. The governor is the chief executive officer of the state of Maine. They make decisions from an executive standpoint. You take the bureaucracy, for example. All of these government programs that are started and initialized by the legislature, the governor runs those. That is the one that is closest to the people. You know, in any service that you're talking about, whether it be labor or economic and community development, you know, HHS, environmental protection, the governor runs those offices.
So Maine has received failing grades for the condition of its infrastructure. I'm talking about transportation infrastructure specifically. Yep. Here. And it currently has a backlog for deferred maintenance of roads and bridges. And this is something that touches every Mainer in the state, right? What we've sort of drifted to is bonds, transportation bonds, to put a Band-Aid on these, on bridges and roads. Is that sustainable, or do we need to do something a little bit different?
No. I mean, I'm going to be a little extreme in my answer here, but I don't think we should be bonding out skinny mix. Mm-hmm. You know, having a 10-year bond on a, you know, on a 3-year coating project on a road, I don't think we do that, but you know, mm-hmm. that's not the answer. What I do think that the answer is we have to look at how we're funding transportation. You know, the highway fund is great, but maybe we don't fund the highway fund through gas tax anymore. Maybe it's part of the general fund. Maybe it should be at the table with every other project in the state. You know, I talked about a lot about different ports and you know, on the sea end of things. You know, that's a big deal. We have a lot of cruise ship companies that want to come to Maine and enjoy what we have here. We should look at port fees. I know in some places we're laughed at for what we charge for a cruise ship to dock, and the cruise ships are the ones laughing at us. You know, I think there's a lot of things that we can look at to fund our infrastructure that doesn't have to be a gas tax. Mm-hmm. You know, low-budget airlines are a thing now. I went to Ireland last summer and got a really cheap ticket out of Providence, Rhode Island, to Dublin, Ireland, and, you know, convincing a low-cost carrier to maybe fly into Brunswick. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a big deal. Every time that plane lands, you get something. Mm-hmm. So I think there are some really innovative ways to get more money into the coffers for transportation that we haven't even looked at yet, because we don't have anybody that has that experience and that view of the world.
Mm-hmm. What are Maine's three greatest assets, and how, as governor, would you leverage those to improve the state?
Mm-hmm. I think I've talked about all of them in different parts of this talk, but I think number one, obviously, is people. Maine people are hardy and resilient. And that is something that we can obviously leverage. I think where we are in the world, you know, our physical location has a lot to offer people. And I think that's something that that needs to be looked at. If Maine could be summed up, it really is the way life should be. Mm-hmm. Maine has a brand and Maine has a culture. And that is something that we can leverage as Mainers. I remember when I was in college, when I said I was from Maine, people thought it was a mystical fairyland. And I think that that is something that can definitely be leveraged to for Maine people to prosper.
Garrett Mason, one of four Republicans in this year's gubernatorial primary race, he spoke with Maine Public's Steve Missler. If you missed either of the candidate interviews in this past hour, you can hear all 14 conversations at mainepublic.org/yourvote. You can also learn more about each of the candidates and see their positions broken down on an easy-to-use issues grid near the top of our Your Vote page. I'm Keith Shortall. Thanks for listening.